Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Today is August 30th. I'm Brett, and what you're going to hear today is something that many of you do not ordinarily get to hear. I thought I would include this one. It's a little something called the After School Sucks Special. Ooh, I hit the scissor arm there. I got so excited about this special. Anyway, we used to do a show that was on the radio, and there were several restrictions as far as what we could and couldn't say, and, you know, a format that we had to follow. But that show would end after a couple hours, and we'd be sitting there with an open stream and people watching, and we decided to do a bit of a looser format, a fun show, an adult show. And sometimes that show includes serious discussions. That's what you're going to hear tonight. It's the After School Sucks Special. There's probably about 40 of them in our AV club. I encourage you to join. Maybe you never have time to listen to any of that stuff, but this show carries, I think, a very important and very positive message, and that's a great way to support what we do. So we take a request. This was the fourth hour of our recording last night. Me and Tony Myers did the show, and there was an article. It was on Slate, or in Slate, on Slate.com. Yes, you would be on Slate. If you send your kids to private school, you are a bad person, by Allison Benedict. So, Tony and I are going to read through this article and discuss it. And, you know, just maybe you are here right now listening to this because you were looking for that article. And I gave the podcast the same name. Well, I don't know what you should do. I promise that if you continue to listen to this, it will be more educational than reading that article, albeit a little more uncomfortable. But I think maybe you should do that if you wound up here by accident. So anyway, I also wanted to use this opportunity. Really, this show can carry an announcement. The website is going to go down today, tomorrow, and possibly Sunday while we do some essential maintenance. There have been some security problems on the site that need to be resolved once and for all. So I would encourage people to avoid any lengthy forum posts or comments because there's a very good chance that that stuff might be lost in this little window of time. That's why I haven't posted anything in the last few days. But I wanted to let you know what's going on because I'm also needing a little bit more time to work through a series called Presence and Productivity, a mini series, a three-parter. It's going to include me because I'm the host, Richard Grove, and Tony Myers, who you're going to hear tonight. It's a lot of audio that I have to go through, and I want to take my time figuring out the best way to put it all together. So if you, are in the mood for some School Sucks podcast, here's a little something to tide you over. And that's it. I hope you enjoy Tony. Tony, I love having him on the show. He's actually been right here in the studio with me. That's where we were last night. We had a great time. I'll even throw in some of our silliness at the end of today's show if you want to see what winds up on the cutting room floor there. So that's it. Thanks for listening. More stuff coming soon. I hope you have a great Labor Day weekend, you know? Power to the people, the workers. I'm still really enjoying this little beatbox as a music bed, are you? Uh-oh, what's about to happen here? Oh no. Yo, I'm the baddest motherfucker on the planet. My dad's name's Jeffrey, my mom's name is Janet. When I was a kid, they told me I should can it. So I just grabbed the notebook and I began to plan shit. And what a plan so long ago to say this is
okay, everybody, welcome to the special for August 29th. I'm Brett. Tony is here with me.
Hello.
And there was a request for us to deal with an article from Slate. The author of this is Allison Benedict. The title is, If You Send Your Kid to Private School, you're a bad person. If you send your kid to private school, you're a bad person. Subtitle, a manifesto.
A manifesto, huh?
You are a bad person if you send your children to private school. Not bad like murderer bad, but bad like ruining one of our nation's most essential institutions in order to get what's best for your kid bad.
Wow, gradations of bad, huh?
So pretty bad. That's the first paragraph. So I think this helps. We always talk about these abstracts like, you know, collectivism, philosophic corruption, self-sacrifice, the virtue of self-sacrifice.
Sure.
Here it is, folks, in action, in the everyday world in which we live.
It's a manifesto.
I am not an education policy wonk. I hate that word. I'm just judgmental. But it seems to me that if every single parent sent every single child to public school, public schools would improve. This would not happen immediately. It could take generations. Well, Jesus, imagine what we could do with generations.
Wow. I think we've already seen what can be done with generations.
Yeah, no
kidding.
You'd
think, but, you know.
Your children and grandchildren might get mediocre educations in the meantime, but it would be worth it for the eventual, wait for it, common good.
Oh, man.
Yes.
The common good. Where have you heard that one before?
Everywhere. Germany. Russia,
it's a necessity.
China, Venezuela, America.
Are you implying there's a communist
Cuba?
Abstract in this?
Yes, rich people might cluster, but rich people always find ways to game the system. That shouldn't be an argument against an all-in approach to public education any more than it is a case against single-payer healthcare.
Wow.
So how would this work exactly? It's simple, I bet. Everyone needs to be invested in our public schools in order for them to get better.
I knew that one was coming.
Yeah.
I knew it.
What does this investment mean? Not just lip service investment or property tax investment, but real flesh and blood offspring investment. Your children belong to us.
Hold on.
I'm going to do the two shot so we can see Tony's reactions to this horror show that's unfolding in front of us.
With the best intentions. We can go over some motivating factors, the person who wrote this one.
Sure, absolutely, yeah. But, you know, we're going to try...
Take it seriously.
Yeah, and we're going to try to...
Dissect it peacefully.
And be empathetic to their position the best we can.
NVC.
Yeah. Oh, this is like an NVC challenge worksheet. It's like this is the worksheet that you give people.
Right.
Okay, that you give to voluntarists. Libertarians, read this article.
That's another method.
Practice empathy for the author. Your local school stinks, but you don't send your child there? Then its badness is just something you deplore in the abstract. Your local school stinks, and you do send your child there? I bet you are going to do everything within your power to make it better.
Really? Really? How much evidence is there over time that that's actually... Okay, calm down.
Mm-hmm.
Breathe.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. NVC.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously... This person has interesting values and has some motivating factors or motivations to, you know, essentially do what might be morally, I don't know, superior, justified, that they, you know, this would be for the greater good because more people, more parents would become interested
mm-hmm.
if their children were forced to go to a government school.
Right.
So, of course, then they would be vested in the system. But how many children go to public school and the parents don't give a fuck what's
right.
happening one way or the other, because I think, you know, the majority of children are already gone to public school. Half the time the parents are utilizing it as a way just for their children to get away from
It relates to our previous conversation. They want it, it's something that they want out of in
yeah
right
that's
because
right.
Your child's education is a monumental undertaking for you personally as a parent when you're already working 40 hours a week.
That's exactly
so
right.
Okay, so look at us, we're practicing a little understanding here. That makes perfect sense. If there is something that people have decided to call education, there's an emotional incentive for you to buy into that.
Yeah.
For you to resist new information, contradictory information, at all costs. Because then, if that's a problem, and everybody knows the schools aren't good, but I don't think people really want to acknowledge the damage that's being done there, because then it comes back into the sphere of things that you have to deal
with. Right, exactly. That's exactly right. It makes it something... internal that they would have to, it makes it very palpable.
Yeah.
Like literally they have to then engage with it because they have some sort of responsibility to the sort of situation.
Yeah.
And that's difficult.
The constructive criticism that I would provide here for the author is that maybe, I don't know if they have kids or not, and maybe they're going to reveal that as they go on, but have you ever tried to work within the system to change the system? This is something that we dealt with on School Sucks Podcast in episode one, because I felt like it was, you know...
It was a moral imperative. Yeah. That abstract to you.
This was a septic system that needed to be emptied right there.
Couldn't have been consciously developed that way.
Well, political solutions do not work, and that's what's being encouraged here. And even though it's not politics in the traditional sense, participating in school politics, the school board. Yeah.
Contradictory argument, because right. they want parents to become more vested in their children's education by essentially outsourcing it to a public institution,
right?
Which we all know how that's working out on a grand scale.
But maybe they're going to provide some evidence. Maybe they're going to provide some information that's new to us, though, as we continue. And parents have a lot of power. In many undersourced schools, it's the aggressive PTAs that raise the money for enrichment programs and willful parents who get in the administration's face when a teacher is falling down on the job. Everyone all in. By the way, banning private schools isn't the answer. We need a moral adjustment, not a legislative one.
There's the moral imperative.
But they're not calling for the explicit use of force. They're saying we need to voluntarily rethink our priorities.
Sure.
Right? And their priorities are different based on them having different information.
That's a very, very empathetic way of looking at
this. I'm doing my best. I'm really squirming in my seat here, but I'm doing my best. All right.
You're doing it better than I am. I'm ready about just to unleash the other side of Tony. The not cool, calm, collected, monotone. The dragon.
There are a lot of reasons why bad people send their kids to private school. Yes, some of them do it for prestige or out of loyalty to a long-standing family tradition, or because they want their children to eventually work at Slate. Drum, hi-hat. What do you call that? Rimshot. Excuse me. drum.
With my perplexed look.
But many others go private for religious reasons, or because their kids have behavioral or learning issues, or simply because the public school in their district is not so hot. None of these are compelling reasons, or rather the compelling ones, behavioral or learning issues, wanting a not subpar school for your child, are exactly why we should all opt in, not out. I believe in public education, but my district school really isn't good, you might say. I understand. You want the best for your child, but your child doesn't need it. If you can afford private school, even if affording means scrimping and saving or taking out loans, chances are that your spawn will be perfectly fine at a crappy public school.
Really?
I'm not even totally disagreeing with that, because, I mean, that's one of the things that we're pushing on this show. Not everybody can leave school. All schools are crappy when it comes down to...
Because they're based on the same state-structured curriculum.
Mm-hmm. And your individual needs.
Yeah, right. I mean, you're forced into having this many credits in order to graduate, whether it's history, English, whatever it be. So the whole curriculum, you know, whether it's a parochial school, which mm-hmm. I went to, which is a religious-based institution,
yeah,
or it's just your standard private school the rich kids go to, or public school, they're all under those same stringent standards. Just different ways of essentially, you know, going through that outcome-based process.
Yeah, so they're all bad, you know?
Yeah.
But...
The structure is the same. It's ubiquitous throughout.
And I'm saying there is a way to survive them. But one of the things that we've acknowledged on this show right from the beginning is not everybody can leave school. I was talking with somebody last night. There is no panacea, everyone drop out of school and teach yourself, because it's just not possible for everybody. I certainly understand that. So I have to accept the idea that you might be able to be fine in a crappy school, which all public schools are. He or she will have support at home, that's you, and all the advantages that go along with being a person whose family can pay for and cares about superior education. The exact kind of family that can help your crappy public school become less crappy. She may not learn as much or be as challenged, but take a deep breath and live with that. Oh, but she's gifted? Well then, she'll really be fine. I'm sorry, that's bad information. Gifted is...
That's a very subjective term.
It's sort of a diagnostic grouping
of, you go.
You know, traits.
Yeah.
But It's the same group of traits that gets kids diagnosed with ADD, ADHD, and gets them put on dangerous methamphetamines.
Yes.
So the idea that your kid is gifted and going to public school doesn't necessarily translate into the outcome he or she will be fine.
Yes.
That's kind of irresponsible.
Yeah. First of all, it's subjective how you determine that, you know, those qualities, because someone, what we're just saying is they have good pattern recognition ability. Mm-hmm. Those are the people we kind of label as special or geniuses in these institutions, or the people that naturally employ the methods we talk about, where they name, they grammar, logic, rhetoric, or, you know, input, processing, output, whatever it be. Mm-hmm. You know, it's employing that method. The smartest kids in my school always, maybe not, didn't look organized, but they were definitely able to learn things for themselves, which is why they were always above the curriculum being taught. So they always had some sort of method, whether they made it explicit or not, of essentially learning things for themselves. And get back to your point, you know, with the trivium, it's one of the things we recognize that parents can't always take their children out of school, but you can still give them methods to use while they're in these institutions that can help them go through the process, even though we know the process is ultimately to sort of stymie, you know, your natural learning ability.
Yeah.
But I mean, her argument essentially, it's contradictory, but it's an argument based on, like, essentially, if we're all vested in the same structure, you know, we're all going to these public schools, people in local communities are going to be more responsible parents, because they're going to be forced to be more engaged with that sort of structure, because they pay for it in property tax already anyways. And all children are going to the same sort of institution. So if, like, something's failing, you have a larger community that might actually reach out and decide that, you know, of parents that might actually go into the school and say, okay, we want to see a change. Mm-hmm. But we do know the school's set up in such a way that what she is referencing is it's a sort of, the outcome-based education we know of. So, like, she's saying that, you know, getting better grades.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of thing, which we know doesn't necessarily translate into actually any sort of knowledge. And so, although she has all right intentions, you know, it's a difficult sort of situation, because there's a larger overarching philosophy in the way we go about teaching our children. And so the idea of making parents more responsible by getting everyone under the same sort of structure.
Yeah.
And, you know, already having to pay through their own tax money, they think that actually might make them more engaged. But I don't know. I think that there's no evidence.
But she might be building her argument here on an experience that she had that we don't know about yet.
There you go.
So we continue.
I speculate.
I went kindergarten through 12th grade to a terrible public school. My high school didn't offer AP classes, and in 4 years, I only had to read one book. There wasn't even soccer. This is not a humble brag. I left home woefully unprepared for college, and without that preparation, I left college without having learned much either. You know all those important novels that everyone's read? I haven't. I know nothing about poetry, very little about art, and please don't quiz me on the dates of the Civil War. I'm not proud of my ignorance. But guess what the horrible result was? I'm doing fine. I'm not saying it's a good thing that I got a lame education. I'm saying that I survived it. And so will your child, who must endure having no AP calculus, so that in 25 years, there will be AP calculus for all. This, you know what this author would be good for, is like giving speeches to soldiers before they run into bullets.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly what I was just thinking about.
It's called the 25-year plan that starts after you die. I'm sorry. That's really, it's frustrating. This is frustrating.
I mean, she's essentially talking about homogenizing it. Everybody.
I think that we could, if we searched, find the point of agreement that school is obviously not necessary for success in life.
But she's talking about that she did fine not having read, or having the ability, at least the way she states it, of necessarily being able to learn these things for herself, maybe.
Yeah.
Because she obviously learned something for herself to be able to go out in the working world and do whatever she does.
Yeah.
Which is right. First slate, but nonetheless, I mean, it's still at some point, it's not always about all the books you've read or all the mathematical formulas you understand and how they relate or whatever. It's more the ability, can you actually learn these things for yourself? And what does that internally mean for you and your own values and what you're trying to do in life?
It also has, this also has a strong tie-in to the Bang, you got some butter on there?
Leftover coconut oil.
There also has a strong tie into the argument that we hear so much that has to do with spanking and the general mistreatment of children.
Right.
It was good enough for me, or these bad things happened to me and I turned out fine.
Now,
this article is also the perfect illustration of that, because I think, you know, to be, if I may just critique this for a minute, it's a very shallow argument. Yeah. And what she's saying is, I am able to produce shallow, poorly evidenced arguments for Slate magazine. So
pretty much
I'm doing
opinion
fine.
Opinion pieces.
Yeah. Look at me.
And because I can do that, I'm okay.
In the same way that these people who talk about hitting children that they don't even have for reasons they haven't even articulated, they're fine too,
yeah.
Right? They just fantasize about beating children, but they turned out fine, you know, just with the fantasies.
It's a reciprocal effect, you know. It's a continual process. We don't recognize this, but it's funny because we always have justifications. Well, it happened to me, and it's called the fallacy of ad populum, right? Appeal to popular tradition or belief or the way it was. It's what happened to me. It's what will happen to you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if we continue to pay it forward with that energy, well, mm-hmm. you know, I think we can see what kind of situation we're now in with that sort of method of always paying it forward. It's like a fractal, you know, and in this case, the fractal is pretty destructive.
Yeah. I mean, paying it forward is fine if what you're paying is not your own needs.
Yes.
You know, like if you can pay it forward at very little cost, great. You know, if you can do nice, what do they call that? Random acts of kindness.
Random acts of kindness.
Fantastic. I think it makes the world a better place, but not at your own expense.
Right. It's about me.
And not like a major expense, because if what she's saying, if she's equating, like, I agree with her because I know school is not education. So it doesn't matter how shitty your school is, right? Because some are technically shittier than others, right?
Technically.
And I've seen a lot of schools, and I've been to Needham, Massachusetts, a very wealthy town. I've seen the facilities. I've seen the resources. So I know there are grades of school quality, even in this general category of shitty.
Yes. Yes. I will grant her that, mm-hmm. but her arguments aren't coming from a sort of like foundational point. She's presenting them all from these like other propositions and all these other tangential aspects, like the quality. I think she's relating the quality of the school maybe to the quality of the institution, technology,
yeah.
books available,
right.
quality of the teachers, which just means, you know, how well they can get the outcome-based procedure into them. Essentially, can they pump out good grades in the state levels of testing and all the shit that goes on with school these days? And so that's one of the keys. Like she's not arguing from like the axiom of what school is.
Mm-hmm.
She's arguing from all these other propositions and premises that back up this institution of how education should be.
The skipped grammar of school is education.
Right.
And that's what's irresponsible
exactly.
too, is that she's saying education is important. Education is school. It's okay if your school is bad. It's okay if you don't get an education.
So it's really the improper definition of education at this standpoint, or the way what she's defining it as. So.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think we would define education as something a bit differently than what how the state runs education or forces it. So
maybe she has perverse incentives here too. Like maybe she wants this generation to grow up and say, you know what I really like? Slate.
That's her whole purpose there.
by the way, my parents didn't send me to this shoddy school because they believed in public education. They sent me because that's where we lived. And they weren't too worried about it. Can you imagine?
Wow.
Take two things from this on your quest to become a better person. One, your child will probably do just fine without the best. So don't freak out too much. But
this is
two,
a socialist argument. I'm sorry.
It is.
I mean, it's socialist economics. That's fine.
But two, do freak out a little more than my parents did. Enough to get involved.
And okay, this is where, you know, I have some empathy. I understand, like, I recognize that what she's trying to do is get parents to be, you know, more responsible and to essentially, you know, get parents to be interested in their child's education.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I'd say the majority of American children and school children around the world, especially in first world countries, most of them go through a public institution deemed from the government, you know. And so, in that perspective, I'd like to see the statistics of how many parents are involved and their sort of school structure. Now, certainly that might, you know, go to the whole quality difference in
yeah.
the facilities and whatnot. Oh, like, or the sort of teachers that populate those facilities. At the end of the day, it's the same structure with the same philosophy, with the same sort of rigid curriculum based, outcome based procedure.
Mm-hmm.
No matter how bad the facilities or how good the facilities are, or how, you know, how good the teachers look or how well they present the material.
So evidence you're asking for.
Evidence.
How dare you? Uh-huh. No, I think that's interesting because, I mean, from her point of view, she's building an argument here that has a lot of, that could have, you know, pretty serious implications for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And it's built on a personal anecdote. So
right.
That is altogether, in my opinion anyway, unconvincing. Also remember that there's more to education than what's taught. As rotten as my school's English, history, science, social studies, math, art, music, and language programs were, going to school with poor kids and rich kids, black kids and brown kids, smart kids and not so smart ones, kids with super conservative Christian parents, and other upper middle class Jews like me was its own education and life preparation. Reading Walt Whitman in the ninth grade changed the way you see the world? Well, getting drunk before basketball games with kids who lived in the trailer park near my house did the same for me. In fact, it's part of the reason I feel so strongly about public schools. Many of my morally bankrupt colleagues send their children to private schools. I ask them to tell me why. Here's the response that most stuck with me. Quote, in our upper middle class world, it's hard not to pay for something if you can and you think it would be good for your kid. Unquote. I get it. You want an exceptional arts program and computer animation and maybe even Mandarin. You want a cohesive educational philosophy. You want creativity, not teaching to the test. You want great outdoor space and small classrooms and personal attention. You know who else wants those things? Everyone. Whatever you think your children need or deserve from their school experience, assume that the parents at the nearby public housing complex want the same. No, don't just assume it. Do something about it. Send your kids to school with their kids. Use the energy you have otherwise directed at fighting to get your daughter a slot in the competitive private school to fight for more computers at the public school. Use your connections to power and money and innovation to make your local school, the one you are sending your child to now, better. Don't just acknowledge your liberal guilt. Listen to it. 28,000 likes on Facebook.
28,000?
Yeah.
Really? I just find it interesting that it's a state imperative. You know, she has good intentions at the end, that she wants people to be involved as to do it through a state institution.
All right, so let's take those last three paragraphs, and because she really, she caught us off guard with a pretty powerful emotional argument there, seemingly.
Yeah.
All right. The first of the three, the last three paragraphs, yes, it is good for people not to be insulated.
Sure.
Right. And I've seen what this looks like. You know, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with the Free State Project or you know, what's going on in New Hampshire, but it's insular.
Sure.
You know, and yep. People are kind of...
The best intentions group thing can set in anywhere at any time. And it's important to be able to branch out to, you know, people that have different values or different ways to approach life and, you know, that whole thing. So it's difficult, but it's important to recognize that and how you relate to them.
Right, right. So there might be a problem in her reasoning or her understanding if she equates private education to shielding children from life, yeah. Which might often be the case.
Sure.
And I've certainly, I mean, and that's not just
I mean,
a trend.
At my institute, or where I went to grade school, I mean, it was somewhat of the case. I mean,
yeah.
Definitely it was people very much of the same class, same race, of the same religious belief, of the same everything, wearing the same clothes. You know, it was a very homogenized environment. And so it's very insular. And it's that sort of structure definitely had a proclivity towards, you know, an air of sort of prestige or just the inability to then go out in the world and relate to a lot of different modalities and beliefs and, you know, whatever else exists out there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the problem with any sort of groupthink or just, you know, that whole aesthetic surrounded in a sort of culture that everything is the same.
So, yeah. So people are being robbed of opportunities to think and make decisions,
yes,
supposedly for their own protection.
Yeah.
In public school, Miss Allison Benedict, this is called zero tolerance. So it's happening everywhere, right? And it has different names. It certainly is a problem, a real problem that you've acknowledged and maybe, you know, inaccurately equated to private school, but these sort of careless attempts at insulating kids from danger or difference or strife or whatever. It's happening everywhere. And I would say that the public school situation is, from what I've seen anyway, with some of these kids, like young kids, elementary school kids being marched out of the school in handcuffs. That's an example of a place where it's really out of control.
Yeah.
Now,
it's enforcing order through more chaos.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just that.
The next paragraph is basically where she quoted the upper middle class people. It's hard to not pay for something if you can and you think it would be good for your kid. So you're being selfish by doing what's good for you when you could be kind of rolling the dice at an attempt to do what might be good for everybody, which there is no such thing in education, right? So the second paragraph is driving at an ideal that doesn't exist.
Yeah, exactly. That's it's an interesting argument because it goes to the idea still yet of that collectivistic mentality. I mean, it's like send children all to the same place and over time it will get better and better. But, you know, if you're limiting the free will or the free choice of parents and maybe parent daughter-son relationship to make an informed decision on what they want to do with their own education. So really, it takes out options and forces you to go with the one for a common good. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all in it together. It's that sort of these abstract arguments for, although it's in a benign sense, it seems like it would be that ultimately over time, it would work out and be a better way to progress society mm-hmm. on a collective scale.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, you share sort of similar experiences and values and the same sort of structure that might be somewhat different at a private school. But at the same time, you know, you remove the free will choice of both the parent and the son or daughter relationship of being able to choose the way in which they want to engage their education. What does that say about people who want to homeschool or, you know, just do a, you know, other very avant-garde forms of education that do exist out there besides just the public school? So that argument that's for like a common good, that you should sacrifice part of your own child's education for the betterment of like society by getting everyone vested into the same structure, is essentially, I think, where the argument falls. You know, it fails essentially because we know the process and pattern of history when we tend to collectivize things.
Yeah,
when
you
move cause and effect, and you have this sort of distance. What John Gatto would say, these thousand layers of complexity. You know, the more right. complexity you put in there, the more people seem to be disengaged and they don't have that sort of cause and effect relationship. So it's not as immediately palpable to them or tactile to them exactly what's happening in their children's education. Mm-hmm. The reason why they're not so engaged in the first place. They're already trying to provide for their family working 40, 60 hours a week, whatever it is. And at the same time, like tell them to be also invested in their education. I mean, that gets pretty difficult.
So we have people like if we're going to take, for example, the bureaucracy that exists in public school and these people who have maybe asserted themselves a little bit in a school board meeting actually, or whatever,
yeah, right.
a PTA, and they see all these layers of complexity, to use Gatto's language, right? Or they see these layers of complexity everywhere in their life, in politics, in foreign policy, in economics, and
it's
they
the same
say,
structure.
Jesus Christ, I've got two kids, I've got a job, I've got a mortgage. Is there anyone out there who can take all of that stuff in the middle and compress it down to almost nothing so I can jump over it and know what to do?
Yeah.
And people are lining up.
That's right.
To provide that service.
Yep.
Politicians, the mainstream media, marketing, like, oh, you don't like what's in between stimulus and response? Well, come on over. Right. Here, there's a bridge.
And it's funny because it also represents a power gap because a knowledge gap is a power gap. Mm-hmm. So the people actually go ahead and enter these bureaucratic, because it's the same structure. It's a linear structure. It's an artificially scarce structure. Only certain individuals can get in certain key positions of power that can actually influence the way the institution operates, so forth and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the, unfortunately for me, from my own experience, is one of the ways in which I've seen people kind of start gaining just local prestige and power in a local community is by getting on the school board,
the
local school board. And that actually will oftentimes lead to a political career. Ironically enough, for some of them, maybe not getting all the way to being a congressman, but they can, you know, influence some aspect of school and then ultimately some aspect of state policy. So it becomes quite interesting because I see this artificially scarce structure as a way to maintain the sort of status quo perspective. Well, I mean, that's the problem with any form of collective arguments. For the common good, to reinforce the common good, you almost have to have energy be static and just maintain itself because it can't be ever evolving, dynamic, and changing. All these parents are going to go rush there and make all these changes. What structure is going to be in place to help facilitate those changes? Who's going to do that?
Right.
I mean, that's it's always that sort of problem when you come up against bureaucratic, you know, situations that we experience almost every institution now.
Yeah. And that brings us to the last paragraph, which is basically the neglected aspect fallacy almost ad infinitum, because there's so many things that could add, you know, detail and points where consideration and thought and questions would need to take place that are kind of skipped over, or you're pushed through it with the emotional momentum of this paragraph and the ones that preceded it. And just to refresh your memory, whatever you think your children need or deserve from their school experience, assume that the parents of the nearby public housing complex want the same. Don't just assume it. Do something about it. Send your kid to school with their kids. Use the energy you have otherwise directed at fighting to get your daughter in all of these places to fighting for things at the public school. Use your connections to power and money and innovation to make your local school better. Don't just acknowledge your liberal guilt. Listen to it. You were writing. And you're chuckling.
First of all, does everyone have the same value system? Everyone has the exact same, you know, values that guide their actions in life and what they hope to achieve, including right. for their children's education. I mean, it's just interesting. You look at like an axiom like human beings act. How do you quantify that action? Well, the only way you're going to be able to quantify that action, you put it all in the same institution and call it the same thing. So although she presents this idea that, okay, people who are in powerful positions already in society, if they send them all to the same school, they can go in there and they can make a big change because they already have some sort of power. But the whole aspect of this is that there really isn't going to be a change. The system is set up in a certain way, so it restricts change in the first place.
Yeah.
That's why it is the way it is. That's why it is what is. If without that, meaning there is no opportunity for difference, for a sort of contrasting style to way to educate your child. And like, you know, it's the lack of any sort of free market perspective in the way in which you engage with it, because the only people are going to be able to actually, and that's ironic because it's sort of touche, because ultimately the people who have power in the society can be the ones that make effectual change, not the people who are probably lower in the power scale.
Right.
Anyways. So the parents that have power, or even though everyone's going to the same institutions, the only ones who have already some sort of power in society or in business, probably only going to be the only ones that can actually make some sort of tangible change in the structure anyways. So there's already a limitation based on the people who have privileged rights, supposedly, in that sort of society or local community.
What that also suggests in that last paragraph is that public schools, and this takes out the, who was it, Alexander Inglis and yeah. the propedeutic function.
Yep.
That Gatto illustrates. Inglis wrote a book. I think Inglis was a Harvard, a professor of education at Harvard University.
Yep.
I learned about him from Gatto, but he wrote a book in the 19-teens, something along the lines of the purpose of, you know, what schools are for,
yeah,
the aims of education, something
aims
like
education or the principles of education or something like that.
Yeah. And one of the things that he illustrated as being built in and the necessity of having this built in to the school system was the idea of a propedeutic or separating function,
yes.
sorting function by, because people's abilities are different. And I've known kids like, children of people that I know, people who are older, who are coming out of NYU, and, you know, they get mail from the Rand Corporation, you know? I mean, those people, they're being sorted, you know?
Yeah.
And a lot of those people who just say, oh, well, here's a great career, you know, in an institution,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
Or a foundation. Wow, I've made it, you know? And they don't really understand ultimately what they're serving. But school was set up to categorize people and sort people and put people into levels.
Yes,
so what's being presented here is that we'll all get together in the same place that has built into it these egalitarian values. And that's just not true. That's not what school is.
Right.
All you have to do is go there. What does Gatto say? Gatto wrote an article. If you've never read it, I suggest you read it. It's called Against School.
Against
it was published in Harper's Magazine, maybe in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
And he talks about this, that, you know, a big function of the public schooling system is to flush the dirt down the drain.
Hence why there's such a quality difference between, like, say, a New York public school, PS, mm-hmm. whatever number you want it to be, versus some, you know, somewhere in the Upper West Side. I'm sure it's a very different structure, or at least the quality. And the curriculum is supposed to be the same, but the quality difference in facilities and the people who go there with a sort of different value structure and what they expect out of their education just reinforces what's been known throughout time as a sort of caste system.
Yeah.
Whether it's conscious or not, that's what it is. You know, there's certain kids that are privileged they get to go to a little nicer facilities, and they'll graduate from them. They'll go to nice universities, they'll graduate from them, and then they'll be positioned in jobs to be, like you said, Rand Corporation, foundations, whatever. But someone from the inner city, you know, does not have that sort of opportunity. In fact, they're pretty much left to, if they even get through the high school structure, the chances of even going on to a higher education to get that, you know, degree that certifies you in whatever is still very small. And so it's, you know, not that any of that means anything. I'm just saying, like, the way things are now.
Yeah.
That's it. There's, it's reinforcing essentially a caste system. And that's
being overlooked here.
Whether it's economic, based on, you know, economic stratification or power stratification, I mean, it's all really related, interrelated. Whether it's economic or power or, you know, where you came from, prestige. But it's, you know, ultimately it's same, it's reinforcing the same sort of artificially scarce, linear stratification. That's how I relate to it.
But what's built into this article is the idea
that it's all in the same. You can get everyone on the same.
The, yeah, the unattainable ideal of fairness.
Yes, that's
complete
right.
Fairness.
That's right.
Which is non-existent.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
One of my few moments of wisdom earlier in my teaching career, when I was a lot less wise than I am now, a kid said to me, "It's unfair because somebody was getting something that they weren't getting." And I said, we're not about fair, you know, we're about healthy, right? And you can be endlessly frustrated by this idea of fair, which is everybody getting the same thing.
Right.
But what I think is more important than fair is healthy, and that's people getting what they need. And maybe I would change that to say getting needs met.
Right.
You know, everybody getting their needs met.
That's extremely
not at
well
anyone
said.
Else's expense.
Yeah, that's extremely well said, because what's fair ultimately is, first of all, it's usually deemed by some other authority, but ultimately it really relates to, are your needs being met and how are you meeting those needs? Because, I mean, the argument for fairness is an interesting one, because I think that's somewhat, somewhat subjective, because usually fairness is in relation to authority granting equal rights, equal whatever, equal distribution to every single individual. So when one sees someone not get the same thing, we instantly reach out and say, hey, why didn't they get that? Or why didn't I get what they have?
Yeah.
Well, why aren't you being creative enough to find ways in which to engage your peers to meet your needs so you can have that same thing if you so desire it? And right. That's the sort of creativity that's lacking. That's the funny thing with this outcome-based education. It lacks the sort of creativity to think outside the box and find a way in which to engage with your peers, maybe present a product or, you know, become an entrepreneur or do whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm. And the half of Gatto's success stories were pretty much kids that went out in the real world, did things that essentially met someone else's needs and able to provide for themselves to do what they ended up wanting to do in life. They didn't have to, you know, be part of someone else's script. They could write their own script.
Sorry, sir, not taught in school. What kids internalize there, you know, sadly, what they internalize is the appeal to authority and the appeal to force.
Yes.
So right. When all you have is a hammer, you know, where are the nails that I can pound? And that's what you're talking about when kids are making this complaint or making this request.
Well said, yeah.
To have their needs met. I don't want to, you know, demean it by calling it a complaint, because I think it is a legitimate attempt to meet a needs. They say, hey, all of this power that you exercise over me, can you divert some of that power and exercise it over so-and-so? Or take away from so-and-so
right.
To give me, you know, so we can balance out the fairness here
right.
Because this isn't a place where we're fostering creativity to get those needs.
Someone's
for me to,
granting it to you.
Yeah.
That's the key. Like, there's an authority granting it to you. Hence why you're turning to an authority to correct the situation.
Right. Use your force and authority to grant me what I need. At somebody else's expense.
They have a special right over you. And let's define authority as just people who believe they have a special right over you.
Mm-hmm.
Not like someone has a special knowledge over you. That's not really what an authority is. Someone who you can contract out to do work with. I'm talking about someone who is like literally making decisions for you or make a decision on your behalf because they have a special right to do so. Or at least they think they do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key, because we all have the same basic motivations for survival. And so I think that's the ultimate grounding platform. So that means no one necessarily has it. No one has a right over you if you get to the foundations. But, you know, what it stymies is what we've been talking about and what your podcast has aptly shown, creativity.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, throughout time, I mean, kids are going to turn to an authority structure to solve this problem. And you see this sort of microcosm with the family and how we engage with the family and the forceful activities we do in the family. And then we see how the state, you know, has manifested as such. And we wonder, like, chicken and egg problem, but you can see the sort of reciprocal effect between the way we kind of treat ourselves, the way we engage with authorities, even within institutions like just schooling, and then the way in which, you know, our federal government now acts. And I think there's a direct correlation there. Because it's just so, once you go down to research it for yourself, which is being creative enough to ask questions. And so the number one thing they stymie or they kind of take out is that whole disability to be creative to, because most kids, I think, would, interestingly enough, but wouldn't be so, have such a proclivity to turn to the authority to say, I want this. I need you to do this for me. Like I need, instead of thinking like, oh, what can I do for myself to get that?
Right.
Without violating the volition of that person. If only we built that sort of internal value structure. It's coming in the next couple thousand years.
So do people agree here that we've come to the conclusion that you're not a bad person if you're not sending your kid to public? I want to see what's developed in the chat.
So there's busybody parents making improvements, ultimately steal the wealth of the community. Yeah, I mean, that's always the collectivistic argument. And taking the money to one central unit, mm-hmm. and then they redistribute it.
Yeah. Is that related to what James says here? To raise public school standards requires money. So these busybody parents demanding improvements ultimately steal the wealth of the community, which lowers other standards. That's a good point.
Yeah. And we see that continuously throughout history. Anytime a government or society in general becomes more collectivized, we see more and more unfair distribution of equity. This actually goes as far back anthropologically to tribal situations where when we went from hunter-gatherers to tribal people where we had a sort of structure and we lived in, you know, static communities, maybe as we developed agriculture, it was very common over time for them to designate a leader of the tribe to make decisions or to explain phenomena that would happen they couldn't explain. And they would usually then collectivize the resources to one area to then redistribute it. And of course, over time, for thousands of years, it's never redistributed fairly. Because that's what happens when you grant one person to do that for the whole society.
And that was even from a pretty benign starting point of this person will be the leader because they're one of us and they've earned our trust.
Yeah, right.
You know, I mean, if you think that's probably the way it played out, it wasn't probably names in a hat.
No.
You know, it was probably somebody who had shown the skills and the sturdiness, emotional and otherwise, to be able to take that responsibility and make those decisions.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, look at the system that we have today. Watch C-SPAN. Why? I dare you. Watch C-SPAN for 15 minutes, people. You will be stunned.
It is stunning. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of surprising for those who have, you know, maybe disconnected from the system a little bit, you know, got off grid, but maybe not in the sense of electricity, but just outside of the normal mainstream media and that whole charade. When you just reconnect to see where it's at, it's somewhat scary, to be honest. Cause I know I have. I don't really watch TV.
Yeah.
And I have my own modalities. I focus my attention to the things that interest me, like learning and Tragedy and Hope and School Sucks podcast and all these different modalities of information I find more useful to meeting my daily needs in life and all these factors. But you then tune back into the system, you see it really is a manifestation of that, you know, Mike Adam or Mike Judge, whatever his name is.
Idiocracy. Yeah. I mean, I checked in on reality TV, like, cause Rich, I was really surprised to learn and, you know, come and spend some time with Rich and learn that he allocates a certain amount of time every week to watch The Soup.
Yep.
Which used to be Talk Soup, which is just like a highlight reel of all the worst. It used to be, originally it was talk shows, but now it's kind of shifted to reality TV.
Yeah.
So I had kind of checked in on reality TV 2 years ago. I couldn't believe how bad it was. We've watched this show a couple of times. I can't believe how worse it is.
That's what I mean. It's a exponential effect.
Yeah.
At this point, it's become exponential. Like, it's becoming worse faster. You know, it's a fractal that's getting closer to that center point of destruction. And it's interesting because with the VMAs recently and everyone talking about that, like everyone from my parents, everyone knew about this crazy pop culture event that went on because it was so, that's the memes they implant in our culture while, you know, this Assyrian chemical, you know, attack, allegedly.
Yeah.
By, you know, the Syrians. But I'll leave that alone. But interestingly enough, most people are engaged with what the news agencies are telling them, which is to be interested in the VMAs and what happened there in juxtaposition to what happened in Syria.
Yeah, I think the first time I ever asked that question was, it was related to an event that involved Janet Jackson's nipple. And I said, what else is going on that we're not supposed to be
looking
at?
That's a good question to ask. All right. Because usually they always, you know, whatever, whether it's planned or not, they always find it convenient when the nation's attention is diverted to completely bullshit topics that have no relevance to being able to meet their needs. It's just pure entertainment. It's pure just let go of all those open loops. It's a way for me to, like, you know, get into that sort of pattern of what's funny that other people are doing that are that self-destructive, because we kind of worship that self-destructive pattern in our culture.
It might sound paranoid what I said too, but, you know, I think about, like, you read some celebrity's Wikipedia page, like an actor, and you see these things that happen. Like, in the recent past, when we live in the same media culture that we live in now, and there's all these things that seem to be skipped over, like, you know, why wasn't this treated like Michael Jackson's doctor, right? Like, so-and-so was arrested for drugs or sexual assault. Yeah. Why was this not, you know? So there is definitely some selection in what gets pushed to the front and exploited by the media. So it is an interesting question to why is this filling time? What else could be filling this time?
Exactly.
It doesn't mean that it's always the case, because maybe there are some stories that are just so compelling in an increasingly dumbed down media culture, but still,
it's star-sucker.
It's worth keeping your ear to the ground.
You know, it's with the whole NSA spying scandal. Mm-hmm. How many people are really interested in that? You know, it's almost like, not saying a nebulous they, who knows, but sometimes test out to see our interest into certain topics that are actually meaningful and relevant. And so sometimes I just have the questions, like, because the amount of people truly interested in that, well, most of the people I know have brushed it off. Or just haven't given any thought to it whatsoever, even though they're stealing.
Or that it's good. It's necessary.
It's a necessary evil, you know, of course. But that's the sort of common replies you get, because most people are in the rat race, too busy and too interested in other people's own self-destruction.
Yeah.
Which is our culture.
All right, folks. So I think we're going to wrap up. I appreciate everyone's attendance and participation. Okay, everyone, that's the end of the show, so you certainly can shut off the recording at this point if you like, but here's a few minutes of the stuff that winds up on the cutting room floor. I warn you, this is unedited. There's little tricks, like, for learning these impressions. You need a running start for some of these people. Like, so for Pacino, I just say the things that I know him saying, right? Yeah. And then, like, what the fuck? Shit. Come on. Get it together.
That's very well
And he's
done.
Always chewing gum. The way you start, here's just a quick impressional tutorial. The fourth tutorial of this live show.
Gotta
start
procedures out of this
looking
shit.
Around the room kind of weird, like you're chewing gum. Now you're getting, you're getting
into the mindset.
Pacino brain.
Yeah, there you go.
This is called. Now there's other ones too, like
you
with Christopher Walken. You just start talking in a New York accent, and then you start to add strange things.
Mannerisms.
To the,
some accents
the accent.
Here and there. That's true.
Morgan Freeman. You can start doing a Morgan Freeman impression by just
tips.
Everything you say, you just start by saying, ever since I was a boy.
Oh, it's not working.
No. Ever since I was a boy. Ever since I was a boy.
That's actually pretty fucking good.
Ever since I was a boy, I have always been fascinated by the lives of penguins. I'm Morgan Freeman.
Narrator of 10 different films. And many more than that.
I would like to recite a poem.
There you go. Recite it.
This is actually a pretty, for you're kind of like a grounded guy. This has been one of the craziest live shows we've ever done.
I'm very grounded.
I
very
thought
calm,
you, yeah.
Very cool, collected, very straightforward. But, you know, I'm not very good at impressions. I can only do a Mickey Mouse impression, apparently.
We have to come up with some kind of a skit where Mickey Mouse.
Smiley, run from the teddy bears.
Mickey. Mickey Mouse came to. Where are you, Mickey?
I'm in East Hartford.
Mickey Mouse came to East Hartford. It's your line.
And I'm learning how to get things done. Hurry, Minnie, let's learn how to do this.
Okay, everyone picture the black and white cartoons.
Ever since Mickey was a boy.
He was afraid of teddy bears.
He always had a problem getting things done.
Too many open loops, Brett.
Mickey set out to clue. I want to see if people are like, fuck you, shut up. I'm going to bed. I'm going to watch Joe Rogan. I'm for not saying it was aliens, but it was aliens.
It was aliens.
Yes.
They invented the school system.
Please put that up. Please just, no one else has to see it. Make it and send it to me. With the picture, I'm for not saying it was aliens. That would, it was my birthday 3 weeks ago.
Oh my goodness.
What a wonderful gift that would be.
If you could hand carve it in wood, it would be even better.
No, just with the picture. I already provided screenshots. Do people need
I'm
more
just
screenshots?
Making unrealistic expectations.
I want to be the star of memes.
See, now they'll be able to do this because they got things done, or they have the method of getting things done. So
right.
They're going to be able to create the Venat alien picture.
Now, here's the other thing, too. I'm not usually this relaxed on these shows.
Really?
I'm pretty relaxed, and I'm good at acting relaxed.
Okay.
But I feel really relaxed. We've got things. I know what exactly needs to be covered. When it's all been covered, I'll edit it together.
We
people
get to goof off in between.
We'll have a wonderful, 2-hour video that they can watch that includes a lot more stuff when everything is said and done.
It's very beautiful. I mean, there's not too many open loops. That's the reason why we can stay relaxed. Mental RAM is clear. Nothing's being cached.
Ever since I was a boy, I've looked for ways to clear my RAM.
Morgan, how'd you burn your hand?
Ever since I was a boy, the Illuminati have tried to burn me. I don't know what that means.